चंद्र काय, ओम नमः चंद्र काय, ओम नमः चंद्र काय, जयंती मंगला काली भद्रकाली कपालिनी दुर्गा क्षमा शिवादात्री स्वाहा स्वाधानमोस्तुते जय त्वं देवी शमंदे जय भूतात्यारिणि जय सर्वगते देवी कालरात्रि नमोस्तुते मधुकाय ताव द्रावी दात्रि वरदे नमः रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि महिषासुर निर्नाशी भक्तानां सुखदे नमः रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि शंभस्यैव शंभस्य धूम्राक्षस्य च मादिनि रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि नाथेभ्यः सर्वधा भक्त्या छन्दिके दुर्तापहे रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि देहि सौभाग्यम् आरोग्यम् देहि मे परमसुखम् रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि देहि देवि कल्याणं देहि परमं श्रियं रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि हिमाचल सुदाना संस्तुते परमेश्वरि रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि इन्द्राणी पति सबारं पूजिते परमेश्वरि रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो देहि द्विषो जयि देवि प्रचण्ड दरदण्ड दैत्य दर्प विनाशिनि रूपं देहि जयं देहि यशो
I wanna know what love is.
dehi duisho jehi rupam de jayam de yasho dehi duisho jehi
Good evening. Good morning for those of you who are up really early or really late. And happy Diwali to all of us. Now here, we're going to celebrate Diwali, the Festival of Lights, as they do in Western India, where I used to live, by invoking Goddess Lakshmi, also known as Shri, the Venerable One, who's the essence of whatever is positive in this world and beyond. And we'll discuss the meaning of Diwali in our practice in a few minutes. This is the culminating lecture. We have more other events coming up, including a Q&A on Saturday morning. But this is the culminating lecture in our five-week immersion in cultivating Shakti. And also, you should know, I'm going to give you a bunch of homework, so hopefully you'll be able to stay cultivating for a while, not just letting it go at the end of this practice, because this structure that we've been able to build together through the grace of Shakti and also through the grace of our practice has an enormous amount of power. It's going in a direction, and as many of you as feel called, just know that if you stay with the vehicle, with the vessel, it's going to take you there. It's going to take you into her heart, which is your heart, again and again and again. You know, right now I just want to thank you all for entering so fully into this class. And because many of you, and certainly me, have been approaching this class as a kind of ceremony, a way of being, of feeling close to Shakti, to Goddess, to the divine feminine, and many of you have shared that there has been a particular power in defacing directly into her during this particular time in the year. I've loved reading about your breakthroughs, the exquisite descriptions of getting deeper into connection with yourself, with her, with mantra practice, with looking at your own patterns. And I've also loved sharing the struggles and the insights that have come with them. You know, all this, the joy and the struggle, is part of the process that unfolds in us when we begin to come into meaningful contact with the liberating face of the goddess, the Anugraha Shakti. It's one of the, you know, most powerful images I know. It actually comes from a Western master, from George Gurdjieff. He spoke often about something he called conscious suffering, which is what in, and I'm not implying that this class has been a form of suffering, but in those moments when you actually begin to really look and to see patterns and old stuff that causes suffering and offer it up, it's that aspect of tapas or conscious suffering that allows the sweet rasa, the sweet juice of grace that is flowing into your system. It's what allows that grace to remove the veils. Hopefully there's been useful information in these last few weeks, but I think we can agree that above all it's been an energetic process, which for you might be triggered in a particular way by a particular teaching or practice, but which is always going on at a much deeper level, often beneath conscious awareness. I want to read you right now a couple of verses from a tantric hymn to Lakshmi. It's actually from Constantina Rhodes' translation, which is in her book called Invoking Lakshmi. So if you're interested in very beautiful English translations and transliterations of a number of hymns and practices for getting close to Lakshmi, this is the book for you. So here we go. Om. I sing the praises of Lakshmi, whose essence is supreme auspiciousness and whose body is made of golden light. She is Shakti, mother of all creation. I sing the praises of Lakshmi, beloved mother of auspiciousness, the eternal one who confers delight, who fulfills all desires and guides all endeavors to successful fruition. I sing the praises of Mahashri, source of wisdom. I sing the praises of Mahashri, source of every success and happiness. I sing the praises of Mahashri, source of all good fortune. I bow to the gentle one, protectress of all who come seeking refuge. I bow to the goddess who sustains the world. Salutations to the cosmic energy, the one whom poets laud as the luster of the moon. Salutations to desire, who incites the passionate arising of nectar. Salutations to devotion. Salutations to intelligence. Salutations to the one who carries us across the ocean of existence. Just as she dwells in the ocean of milk, may a portion of Shri ever dwell in my body. Just as she exists in the sun and the moon, may Shri exist in me always as Lakshmi and her beloved Lord. In Shakti-focused sadhana, sadhana is often done with the goal of feeling intimacy with a form of Shakti, a feeling of Shakti, a particular goddess form of Shakti. It's a particular understanding of sadhana that is focused less on transcendence, focused less on conventional liberation, if you will, much more on depth of connection. In this practice, we literally want to be with her, to sit near her, to take her into ourselves. And in formal Shakta sadhana, there's a lot of ritual, visualization, we've done some of that, mantras are intended to allow us to feel the presence of the divine. First of all, in our sadhana space, at our meditation mat, in the ritual space, but really ultimately in our entire life. The practice is to draw Shakti so deeply into ourselves that eventually as you become closer and closer, more and more intimate, she actually becomes one with you. And you're able, and this is really the key, you're able to see the world through her eyes. You're able to see the world through her eyes. As, you know, it's been like that for many of us in this class. Our practices of cultivating Shakti have been giving us moments, days, weeks, and deep insight into, you know, what it actually means to be fully connected with Shakti, both inside ourselves in a form and in the world, in her form as the natural world. And for many of you, it's the form of the goddess Durga has been significant, and I know some of you who have not practiced with Durga have been, you know, quite astonished at the power and love that she unfolded for us, that she has unfolded and continues to unfold for us. But for others, the experience of closeness to Shakti has been subtler, less connected to a particular form, very internal. And I felt, and I know I've said this before, it was very important, I felt, that we get to take support from the cosmic timing of this gathering. You know, we've undertaken to sit near and hopefully to receive the revelation of our true relationship with Shakti during two of the holiest festivals, goddess festivals of the year. You know, the festival of Navaratri and now Diwali. This is the culmination. It really is a kind of Purnahuti, which means Purnahuti means ultimate offering or the final offering, the complete offering. That's what we're here for. And I want to say also that for many of you, especially those of you who come from Eastern India, Assam, and I assume it's the same way in Bengal, Diwali is a Kali festival because the great temples in that part of India are dedicated to goddess as Ma Kali. Kali's love is as strong as her fierceness, and you know we've been experiencing that during these weeks dedicated to Durga, because Durga and Kali are two aspects of the same divine, fierce, revolutionary aspect of the goddess. And one reason why we've had such deep purification of samskaras is really through the power of, and I would call it the initiatory power that Ma Durga has been making available to us as she shows us her patterns, clears karmic residue, and offers insight into this deep, deep truth that we're never separate from her. And of course, since we're participating in the collective karma of this moment in history, which is not an easy one for anybody, it's a fraught time. But because we're aligned with the Cosmic Mother, and to the extent that we've offered ourselves into her hands, we've been able and will continue to be able to use the energy of this time on the planet for growth, for purification, for blessing, and for bringing more depth to our practice, and even feeling joy. It's as this process goes on, we start to experience the purpose and really the gift of this process of Shakti Sadhana. We've started to experience that it is actually true that our practice and our invocations create the conditions that allow Shakti to melt away the samskaric backpack that hides your light. You know, much of the way spiritual practice is approached around the world is as a kind of self-improvement project, and this is natural and inevitable. It's how we do everything in life as human beings. We, you know, put our nose to the grindstone, as it were, and we make effort, hopefully in the right direction. And, of course, we're making effort here. But what you come to understand as you do this practice is that the true purpose of this entire process is to allow Shakti to do the work of removing veils so that we can see the truth about ourselves. So we practice on this path not for self-improvement, not for spiritual attainment, not because we think we can make the big breakthrough ourselves, but we practice in a spirit of deep listening and with great humility. We invoke her with steadily growing trust, and we open ourselves as much as we're able to allow her to soften the heart and liberate us from karmic obstructions. You know, divine grace is real. The liberating current of Shakti is real and present, and it's certainly not a myth or a story that when you open yourself to her, she will come to meet you, and she'll take you with her. It's exactly what we're doing here. And it's really part of the process of that aspect of Shakti Sadhana that is called Upasana. And we'll get into that also in a few minutes. So right now, we find ourselves at the lake. So just begin by inhaling and exhaling, and as you exhale, feel yourself letting go of the day. Feel the breath settling you. And now begin to allow the breath to set you in a posture. We're in the Himalayas, seated around the most beautiful crystalline deep blue lake, Lake Manasarovar. We can see the white-capped mountains in the not-too-distant distance, ranges and ranges and ranges of them lost in the clouds. And we can feel the mist of grace that rises from the lake. So in this moment, as you settle yourself here, become aware of the presence of each one of us seated in a circle around the lake. Maybe you'd like to also invite someone in your life, someone who's not taking the course, to be present here. And in this moment of entering into our conversation and entering into our sangham, allow the breath to enter your body as a soft wind that flows from the lake, flows through the inhalation, and flows down towards the base of your body, grounding your sit bones, making your lower body heavy. And then with the exhalation, feel the breath drawing your torso upward through the spinal column, all the way up to the crown. Your shoulder blades release and melt onto the back. Your chest lifts and opens. Your head is poised as though held by a slender thread from dropping down from the heavens. And as you inhale, now you feel the breath entering and softening any tensions or tightness or holding. And as you exhale, you have the feeling of letting that go. Just let yourself breathe and soften, breathe and soften. To soften, of course, is to allow softening to happen. It's not a forceful attempt to soften. It's really a self-offering, a willingness to open to the vulnerability that comes when we are willing to let go of our armoring. In your cupped hands, you find a tea light held in a very beautiful jeweled cup. And you can exercise one of your superpowers and light the tea light with your forefinger. And place your intention for the evening, which can be for yourself, for someone else, a general wish for blessing. You place your intention in the flame, and you place the cup in the lake. As you do, behind your closed eyes, you become aware that the goddess Lakshmi is sitting on the lake. Durga has taken the form of Lakshmi, who is part of her, who is an aspect of her. And she is fully present, filling the entire space. So if you're so inclined, and if it feels natural, you can imagine the goddess as the beautiful golden one, robed in red, covered in gold and jewels, her hands dripping with gold coins, her face gently smiling, everything about her gentle and beautiful. But you can also sense her as a presence of light, as a feeling, as the general sense of Shri, of auspiciousness, of positivity. Just know that she's present with us. And with that recognition and understanding, we'll chant our mantras in praise of Shakti, who is the source of the power of all the assemblages of energy that manifest this world. We'll chant the Gayatri, invoking She who enchants the universe. And we'll chant the mantras to Lakshmi in the form of Narayani, the supremely auspicious one. So find your chanting sheets. We'll chant each mantra twice. And then I'm going to chant the Lakshmi Gayatri, which many of you know, and if you don't, feel free just to listen for a moment. So your awareness is in your heart, and at the same time, you're aware of the presence of the goddess in front of you, behind you, around you, above you, and below you.
Yasyonmeshanimeshabhyam jagata pralayadayau tam shakti chakra vibhava parabhavam shankaram stumaha. Yasyonmeshanimeshabhyam jagata pralayadayau tam shakti chakra vibhava parabhavam shankaram stumaha. Sarvamohinye vidmahe Vishvacharanye dhimahi Tano shakti prachodayat. Sarvamohinye vidmahe Vishvacharanye dhimahi Tano shakti prachodayat. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sarike Sharanye triambake gauri Narayane namostute. Sarva mangala mangalye Shive sarvatra sarike Sharanye triambake gauri Narayane namostute. And the Lakshmi Gayatri, which you don't have on your sheets. Om Mahalakshmiye cha vidmahe Sarva Shaktiye cha dhimahi Tanno Lakshmi prachodayat. Om Mahalakshmiye cha vidmahe Sarva Shakti cha dhimahi Tano Lakshmi prachodayat.
We ask that through the power of our practice, all beings experience happiness and the causes of happiness. We ask that all beings be free of suffering and the causes of suffering. We dedicate our practice asking that all beings be free of grasping, aversion, and dullness. We ask that we and all beings experience the equality of all that is. And so it is. You're feeling the presence of Goddess, the sense of her graceful presence emanating from the lake,
experiencing a mist of grace and protection, experiencing her as a presence that wraps around each of us and all of us. And as you turn your focus inward to the natural rise and fall of your breath, sense that each inhalation welcomes the particles of grace rising from the goddess. As you exhale, soften. Your face softens to receive this blessing. The muscles around your eyes soften. Inhale the mist of grace. Exhale with the feeling that the shoulders soften, the neck softens. Inhaling grace, allow it to penetrate your belly, your lower back, any areas of tension to melt. Every inhalation welcomes grace. Every exhalation melts contraction from the body. And as each area of contraction melts a bit, you feel more and more present to yourself. You become more and more able to rest deeper into your own being. I'd like to speak for a moment about something that many of you are very familiar with, but which is key to the Shakta practice. Your Shakta practices can have a shamanic component, which also means that they're very, very connected to the rhythm of the natural world, including the rhythms of the lunar calendar. The fundamental principles of tantric non-duality is as here, so elsewhere, or what appears in the macrocosm also appears in the microcosm. In other words, we find the cosmic within the biorhythms of our life, and we find our personal biorhythms mirrored in the cosmos, you know, on the level of the great cycles. The fundamental rhythm of life is this constant flowing in and out of manifestation, a rhythm of manifestation, sustenance, and dissolution that appears on every level of reality, from the movements of the constellations to the life of the cells. And the great insight of this tantric path is the discovery that the so-called mundane world and the so-called spiritual world are actually one world. And that means that every movement of energy we experience is our individuated version of a much larger macrocosmic energetic flow. In other words, if it's happening up there, we're going to feel it down here. I'm going to say that again. If it's happening up there, it's happening down here. And if it's happening down here, it's happening up there. There is total connection. Given the fact that every one of us experiences cosmic rhythms according to our own nature, our own karmas, you know, with all of the complexities of that, nonetheless, these rhythms are being played out in every aspect of this multiverse, including in our own bodies and psyches. You know, again, as you know, the primal Shakti holds, or even we could say consists of, three forms of energy: the energy of divine will or divine desire, the energy of knowing, and the energy of activity. And these, of course, are mirrored in our own power to desire, which we're going to talk about pretty soon, and our own ability to know and to think, and in all the impulses that lead to action in the world. And these all play out in societies, in cultures, and in cosmic forms that we are not really aware of. You know, in agricultural and hunter-gatherer societies in the ancient world, including the Vedic world and also the Middle Eastern world, there was always, the Celtic world, there was always an insight being expressed that led to seeing the rhythms of the natural world as expressions of goddess. You planted by the moon, you harvested by the moon, you asked for her grace to help you. You followed diurnal rhythms, you saw the sun seeming to be born every morning and disappear every evening. And if you've ever done that, if you've ever been, you know, on a vision quest or someplace where you actually are living in the rhythms of sunrise and sunset and moonrise and moonset, you know how profoundly connecting this is. You watched the moon wax and wane, dissolve, reappear, grow, and shrink, and yet knowing, you knew that the moon is always full. So the idea of transformation and impermanence and change held in an overall fullness, completeness, is very much part of our connection to the rhythms of the moon. And you would see these rhythms in your body, in your menstrual cycles, in the relationship between sexuality and new life, between orgasm and cosmic ecstasy, even your breath, which the Vedic seers, as you know, understood to be flowing through two channels, the Ida and the Pingala nadis, or channels, which are related to the moon and the sun. And, you know, in Vedic science, you learned how to time your activities to the flow of breath in these channels and these nadis. You know, and you made offerings to your personal form of the goddess, addressing her by name, knowing that as you did so, you are actually mediating between the human world and the world beyond. That's very much the energy behind Vedic ritual. And it also seems to have appeared in, you know, many of the rituals of the original Western cultures. While the religious cultures of the West eventually turned to an exclusive form of monotheism, elevating their tribal deities as the one and only and demonizing all other sacred forms, Indian religious philosophy at its best held the paradox of the one and the many, recognizing that the myriad forms of deity are all faces of the one. For Shakta practitioners, all forms, including you, but also including the many local goddess forms, some of the ones we've been invoking, to be rays or emanations of the one mother goddess, the Mahadevi, who is ultimately discovered to be you yourself. So in other words, when you cultivate Shakti in this tradition, your intention is to see Shakti, to see the goddess constantly in play, at play in your world. And, you know, I just want to say that as moderns, we don't want to
confuse this kind of attunement to the natural rhythms with a kind of regression to pre-scientific understanding about the world. We never want to ignore the important gifts of modernity. What we're cultivating as moderns is simply to find our natural connection to the fundamental rhythms of our inner and outer life and learn to flow with them so that every phase of the cosmic cycle lets us deepen our relationship, our nearness to the divine force. You know, one thing that the non-dual Shakti traditions emphasize is that the portals the Shakti creates in the flow of experience, where her foundational Shakti becomes especially accessible in the normal flow of our embodied lives. So goddess is everything, but in the Shakta science, we learn that she's specifically, particularly accessible through the phases of the breath, through language. We've been working with all these forces, these forms, as the energy within feeling and emotion, including sexuality, and as the power within attention, within awareness. In fact, as we're going to be seeing a little bit later on, one of the signals of heightened Shakti is found in our connection to the erotic. So I want to just say a few things about what that really means in practice. You know, many modern teachers conflate Shakti with sexuality, but to understand how, which it is, you know, there's enormous Shakti in sexuality, but to understand how Shakti is expressed as the erotic, it's important to recognize that Eros doesn't just refer to sexual love. It also includes the entire spectrum of heightened perception and feeling. So whenever you feel a strong positive charge, a strong sense of presence, a strong feeling of connection, you are experiencing Eros, which means that you're experiencing Shakti. And this is one of the places I think we instinctively turn to feel Shakti. We turn to heightened experiences, to the way we feel at a rock concert, to the way we feel in front of a beautiful painting if we're aesthetically available to that kind of experience. Now, the great Shakta teacher, Abhinavagupta, taught that by heightening our appreciation for the aesthetic, we find ourselves in direct contact with the primordial power. So, and in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, which many of you have studied with me or other teachers, in the Vijnana Bhairava Tantra, there are several practices for using the taste of food to take you to the source of the pleasure of taste, or using the arresting first glimpse of a beautiful object, or many of the other experiences of the senses, including sexual experience. There's two meditation practices that involve recognizing sexual experiences. But most significant here is that one of the most powerful ways to cultivate Shakti is to cultivate appreciation. And we do that partly by cultivating our inner and outer senses, by sharpening our senses, by heightening our senses. So in the Indian classical music world, it's said that if you really want to appreciate the exquisite beauty of music, you actually have to become a rasika, someone who knows how to find the rasa, which to me is identical to the eros, the juiciness that's available within every contact between your senses and the world. You know, the Sanskrit word rasa means taste or juice or flavor. And rasa is also the erotic sap that enlivens matter, that gives the power to be moved, to be changed, to be excited, to be uplifted by sensory experience, both inner and outer. So pleasurable sexuality, pleasurable food, the exaltation of art, especially dance and theater and music, and the experience of natural beauty are the abodes of rasa. And they're everywhere in nature. You know, I find that, and they're especially, however,
they're especially present no matter what our circumstances in the moon. You know, when I'm in Manhattan where the natural world is pretty much covered with concrete, it feels so powerful to look up at the moon hanging above the lights of the city. And when the sky is relatively clear, you can always see it. And, you know, if you unexpectedly glimpse the moon, you know what I mean. It's like a darshan. It's like an epiphany of sacred nature, reminding us that there's something transcendent shining above our human contraction. And, of course, now we know that the moon is a dead body orbiting around the sun. People have gone and stood on it and picked up moon dust and moon rocks. But that's just the physical side of the moon. Let's say the cosmic side of the moon, the inner aspect of the moon, the metaphysical meaning of the moon is just as mysterious to us when we look up at it shining in the sky as it was to the ancients, even though we know what it is we're really looking at. And what we often don't realize is how much the phases of the moon affect our states of mind, because the transitions that go on not only in the tides, not only in the menstrual cycles, you know, not only in the rising and falling of the breath through the phases of the moon, it's very easy to forget, but incredibly powerful. So the Shakti festivals like Navaratri and Diwali and Easter and Passover and other lunar festivals are actually, in a certain sense, homages to the natural cycles of the moon and the seasons. And they are portals. And I know you know this. I know we know how these lunar festivals expand and open us. So if we actually celebrate them, I mean, really celebrate them, not just go, oh, happy Diwali, but, you know, do some chanting, offer some food, do a little bit of puja. They give us periodic opportunities to reconnect and deepen our relationship to the great cosmic Dharma, who is the earth, you know, of the mother, who is the earth, the sky, the generative and gestative process, and the radiance hidden in our body. So Diwali is one of the most significant of these, and I want to share with you a little bit of the cosmic mythology around this festival, and I want to thank the Vedic astrologer Katie Jane, who gave me this particular astrological approach to Diwali. The word Diwali means, is short for Deepavali, and the D refers to a dia or a deepa, which is a small light, like a tea light, which is offered to Lakshmi as we've been making offerings to the lake. And of course, that light represents the light of the soul, literally, the thumb-sized flame in the heart, and the same thumb-sized flame that lives in the Ajna Chakra, which are microcosmic versions of the great light that's the ground of everything in the cosmos. The feeling of Diwali takes place at the darkest time of year, literally the time when the light of the sun is in retirement. And the new moon is, you know, the time of the dark of the moon. It's a dark time. So, and interestingly, in Diwali, astrologically, the sun is at its weakest point. It's in the Vedic constellation of Swati, which is the sign of its debilitation. And what that means for us is that the outgoing solar energy is depressed. You might have noticed that. Which ideally should encourage us to look inside for the light we can't find in the external world. But since the sun is also the macrocosmic signifier of the personal ego, our egoic preoccupations are also tend to be diminished during this time and often foiled during this time. It depends, you know, on your circumstances. But it because the ego is smaller, is less obstreperous, it's a particularly powerful time of year to do worship, self-inquiry, practice surrender, and really look at where we are. So this, the Diwali is takes place during the month of Kartik, which is one of the holiest months in the Vedic calendar, and offers us an opportunity, which the Vedic calendar is very purposeful about, to connect to a particularly strong opportunity to evolve spiritually. So, you know, and this will happen, you know, this capacity to use the seasons to power our spiritual practice becomes more and more natural as we become more sensitive to the energies of the planetary field and learn to align our inner priorities with the felt sense of cosmic timing. You know, to align with cosmic timing is one way of aligning with the flow of Shakti in the cosmos. You know, you may do this intuitively, naturally, based on a gut feeling or a felt sense of the energy in a particular moment. Some people do it by consulting astrologers. It's one of the reasons why it's such a strong custom in India and other places to actually find out the auspicious moment for doing something, because if you find a moment in which the flow of energy in the cosmos is towards growth and expansion, it will empower whatever you are beginning at that moment. So, you know, you don't try to make something happen if you have this understanding. When it's not the right time, remember that great phrase in Shakespeare, there is a tide in the, I think it's Henry V, there is a tide in the affairs of men. We, you know, success in this world depends to a very great extent on learning how to move through the seams of reality, to ride the current that lets you seize the tide. And you can do this more and more accurately as you enter your deep heart, as you start to trust your sense that the energy of a particular time is either suited to the project that you want to do, or will create obstructions, so the project is best left to another time. And this understanding about time also applies to the milestones in our spiritual journey, because, you know, every month, this is very much an aspect of the Vedic calendar, is, you know, contains days and moments that are particularly powerful for spiritual practice. And these moments are often connected to the waxing and waning of the moon. So the new moon in Kartik is one of those moments. It's a portal moment. And there's a gestational quality to such moments during which our spiritual potential can be experienced very directly. So like the tiny gap between the in-breath and the out-breath, the little window between one thought and another, the new moon is a window that can allow your consciousness to expand in this kind of pregnant darkness when the moon is hidden. And in the new moon, during the new moon in Kartik, which is one of the, you know, darkest times of the year, it's much darker than the solstice. Remember, at the solstice, the days start to get longer. The journey of the sun becomes more expansive. At this time of year, in October, November, the days are becoming shorter. The sun is spending less time shining, at least in the northern hemisphere. Of course, the process is reversed in the southern hemisphere. And one of the legends of the goddess Lakshmi is that during this time, she ascends from within the darkness to reveal herself as the inner light in all of our souls. So Diwali is also a harvest festival, which is, of course, how most of us know it. Famously, in many places in India, it's the time when merchants add up their profits and losses and then offer their account books to Lakshmi with prayers of gratitude and ask for her blessings for abundance of the new year. And I follow this practice myself. I always put my cash, my checkbooks, my credit cards, often my computer, on the altar, and I offer them flowers, and I consider them in that moment as forms of Goddess Lakshmi, and I honor them for the ways in which they've facilitated my life. So for us as individuals, this is actually a powerful and very natural time to kind of look at our year, to look at what we've accomplished during this year. in the field, in the realm of abundance, of fulfillment? In what fields of our life have we successfully planted and reaped a harvest? What have we overcome? So I'm going to ask you to do this in the homework, but we're going to do just kind of glance at it in the next few minutes from the point of view of the eight aspects, the eight faces of Goddess Lakshmi. We've been planting and cultivating Shakti together for the past 5 weeks. So we have an opportunity now to, as it were, gather up the particles of blessing from this time and also from our year, to savor them and then to offer them. So Lakshmi's eight forms represent eight facets of abundance, which manifest as the eight most fundamental avenues of success and prosperity in human life, of course, including money, but also food, good fortune in general, children, leadership, courage, success, and wisdom. So as I mention the names of these forms of the goddess, take a moment to look inside and just see if you can get a feeling of how they're manifesting in your life right now. How do you feel connected to abundance in these areas? You know, fundamentally, abundance is the feeling of having enough. It's not necessarily about being rich. It's about being satisfied. It's about having that which you value in sufficient abundance to give you contentment. You know, first, the primary form of the eight Lakshmis is called Adi Lakshmi. Adi meaning original or primordial. So Adi Lakshmi is the primordial goddess who is one with Durga and all the great manifestations of the divine feminine. She represents overall good fortune, not only for individuals, but also for societies and for the planet herself. And how do you think Adi Lakshmi is manifesting right now? When you think about Adi Lakshmi as a force in the cosmos and as a force in our societies, we start to realize that maybe we could be doing a little bit more cultivation. So Adi Lakshmi is all about value. She's the wealth that arises when we're aligned with our true source. And she's very much connected with self-worth, with self-value. You know, she's health. She's the strength of our physical constitution. She's the nourishment we get from family and friends. She's our feeling of safety. And she's our ability to nourish ourselves and other people. Now you might want to ask yourself, do I have a feeling of safety, of value in my life right now? Am I valuing myself enough? And what do I base my feeling of self-value on? What do I really value about myself? These questions ask a lot more contemplation than we're going to give them, but I think as you ask them or as I ask them and you take them in, you'll start to get a sense of what it is that you actually want to contemplate. So, but now we offer a prayer. May I and all beings experience true prosperity. May I and all beings experience alignment to the highest values and the gifts that arise from alignment. The second form of Lakshmi is the most famous, Dhana Lakshmi, D-H-A-N-A, who is money, gold, all forms of monetary wealth, I guess, including Bitcoin. So Here's the question. Have you felt financially stable this year? Do you feel relatively relaxed about your finances? Are there issues that you want to contemplate and address? And you may notice as you ask this question, and again, this is a huge topic, and one which we have a lot of lore available to us in this society. But as you bring up these questions for yourself, let's offer a prayer. May I and all beings experience sufficiency, financial sufficiency. May we have enough to sustain us. The third form of Lakshmi is called Dhanya Lakshmi, and she's Lakshmi as food. And she's also the Shakti who gives us the power to receive nourishment. So when you have the grace of Lakshmi in this form, your food nourishes us. This is a big deal for me right now, you know, because I'm not receiving much nourishment from the food I eat. And a lot of my practice in this Lakshmi period today has been really to ask for her help in being nourished. So when we have the grace of Lakshmi in this form, our food is taken in and used by every cell in our body and really becomes the platform for every form of unfoldment, including spiritual unfoldment. So are you assimilating the food you take in? Is eating and weight an issue that you've dealt with this year in a positive way? Food and money, man. I mean, these two Lakshmi issues are such a big deal for humans. So here's the prayer. May I and all beings be fully nourished by the food we eat and by the attitudes with which we take in food. May what we eat be healthy. May it be harvested with full awareness. May it come from sources that will help us grow in love. May no harm beyond what is a natural part of life come to those who are our sources of food. And may healthy food be available to everyone everywhere, including the plants and the animals who will eventually become human food sources. May they be nourished at every moment of their lives. The fourth form of Goddess Lakshmi is called Gaja Lakshmi. Gaja means elephant, and it refers to the traditional mount of Indian rulers, Indian kings. So, and Gaja Lakshmi is the Shakti that gives us the power to lead, you know, to lead in the sense of taking self-responsibility, you know, leading ourselves, literally ruling our minds, ruling our bodies, leading ourselves to alignment in the highest way. And of course, it also gives us rulership, leadership, power, and all forms of worldly power and influence. She expands our ability to use our own connection to divine power to offer positive grace and support to other people, to a family, to an organization. So, accessing the power of Gaja Lakshmi and learning what our particular leadership or rulership ability is actually a supremely important way of aligning ourselves with our destiny, with the highest forms of karma, and also with all the aspects of self-rulership which allow us to be spiritually available. So how have you led or influenced others this year? How have you acted as a leader to yourself? And here's a prayer. May all beings take responsibility for the consequences of our own decisions and actions. And may our leaders, our rulers, lead in such a way that the people in their, under their care benefit from their leadership. May we have good leaders at this time of so much need. The next form of Lakshmi is called Santana Lakshmi, and she is the goddess of childbearing and fertility. If you know anyone who wants to get pregnant or who has a particular need to nourish children, Santana Lakshmi is the goddess, the goddess she would approach for help with that. So is this a year in which you felt close and connected to children? In which you've been nourished by children? And make a prayer now. May the children of the world, including my own children, be safe. May they be loved. May they be mentored. May they be encouraged. May they reach their highest potential. And you may have found during this course that you're actually connecting to your own inner child. So this would be a place to consider asking for the blessings of Santana Lakshmi. Dairya Lakshmi, D-A-I-R-Y-A, is the power of courage. She's the Shakti that gives you the inner strength and stamina to take risks, to stand up for something that matters to you, and on the spiritual path, to keep going, to keep sitting down for practice, even when you'd rather have a root canal than meditate. You know, it's the courage it takes to face up to the inner obstructions that your sadhana is going to bring up and release. So consider the forms in which you've experienced courage and acted courageously this year. What do you realize when you consider courage to be a gift of Shakti? Not something you have to dredge up from somewhere else, but something that is being offered to you at every moment and that you can allow yourself to receive and act through. And here's the prayer. May all beings have the strength and courage to do what is necessary, to do what will be of benefit, to do what is right, what is aligned with truth, both in our personal lives and in the life of society. May we have the courage to do the hard stuff. Jaya Lakshmi is the face of Lakshmi who gives success in all your endeavors and allows you to overcome, to literally have, Jaya means victory. It allows you victory in whatever you undertake. So what does true success look like to you now? Not necessarily the People magazine kind of success, but success in relationship to your own deepest skills and talents and integrity. What is success for you right now? Does it have to be a big deal? It can simply be the experience of having made progress in some area which is difficult for you, or completed a project. Now make a prayer. May all beings have success in every beneficial endeavor. May my successes be of benefit to all. And finally, Vidya Lakshmi, who is the wealth of wisdom and skill, both spiritually and worldly, but normally having the connotation of spiritual wisdom, of Dharma wisdom, of the ability to develop positive qualities like generosity and kindness. So these positive qualities are also gifts that come to us when we practice upasana, sitting with the goddess. So in sitting with the goddess during this time, what did you learn about yourself? How is your spiritual practice transforming you? Can you see the ways in which truth is being revealed or awareness is being expanded? And here's the prayer. May our wisdom and skills, our strategies, our creativity, and above all, our spirituality serve the highest values. And may we have the wisdom to realize that all beings are one, and that our planet, our society, is not a bunch of separate objects and people, but a single tapestry of wholeness. And you can close your eyes. And focus very sweetly on the breath. We're going to do a series of meditations, short meditations. With two of the seed mantras associated with Lakshmi, which also appear in the Durga mantras that we've been chanting. So the mantras that we'll be practicing with are Om Hrim Shrim. And you can begin by bringing your attention to the perineum, the area at the base of the spine, the area of the Muladhara Chakra. And inhale and exhale with your attention there. Not necessarily trying to make the breath sink down to that place, which is not always easy, but feeling that the mantra, Om Hrim Shrim, is literally being placed inside your perineum, inside your muladhara. Inhale, Om Hrim Shrim. Exhale, Om Hrim Shrim. see if you can feel the energy in the syllables as you focus on the perineum. With the next exhalation, feel that Om Hrim Shrim rises from the perineum into the heart, into the area within the chest. Om Hrim Shrim in the heart. Inhale, and then with the next exhalation, let the mantra Om Hrim Shrim float upwards into the region in the center of your head, behind the eyebrows. And allow yourself to feel the energy in these syllables touching the Ajna Chakra. Inhale now with the breath flowing downward. And once again place Om Hrim Shrim in the perineum. Feel the syllables of Om Hrim Shrim flowing in the perineum. And then with the next exhalation, sense the syllables flowing up to the heart. Om Hrim Shrim. Inhaling and exhaling. Om Hrim Shrim in the heart. And feel the mantra flowing out with the exhalation up into the third eye in the center of the head. Om Hrim Shrim, repeating itself. In the third eye center. And one more inhalation. Again, feeling the presence of Om Hrim Shrim in the perineum. Inhaling and exhaling. And with the next exhalation, your attention and the syllables of the mantras flow into the center of the head. Om Hrim Shrim. Om Hrim Shrim. Now see if you can feel the flow. the mantra with the breath in the perineum area, in the heart, in the center of the head. You may find as you do this practice that you want to reverse it. In other words, that after you have flowed up through these three centers with the mantra, that in the next movement you want to flow down. So you would let your attention flow from the center of the head to Om Hrim Shrim in the heart, and then Om Hrim Shrim in the at the area of the Muladhara. Find your rhythm as you allow these syllables to infuse these three centers with the powerful shakti of these syllables, which are forms of the goddess Lakshmi, and which carry the shakti of auspiciousness. Lakshmi is a goddess of life in the world. You know, Durga and Lalita and Kali all have an open third eye in their forehead, which symbolizes the fact that that part of their mandate is to awaken non-dual consciousness in us. Lakshmi does not have an open third eye, even though she is very much able to awaken us. But she is essentially one of the Shaktis who sustains life in duality, who upholds the internal dharma that enables us to both create a successful life within Maya and to use that as a way of transcending. And that means, you know, as the tantric sages have always tell us, is that she's especially a goddess for householders, for those of us who are navigating the ups and downs of life in the world. And what she shows us, this is my experience with Lakshmi, is that when we're aligned with her, we are actually able to ride our own internal forces of ignorance and fear and actually find a way to balance the forces of opposition. You know, the world of Maya is a dual world, it's a dualistic world. It's filled with opposing forces. And yet, one of Lakshmi's gifts is the ability to celebrate paradox, to resolve paradox. I've recently been contemplating the idea of paradox because it seems to be so hard for so many people in this current moment to understand that all of us contain light and dark, so-called auspicious qualities and so-called inharmonious qualities. And reality is the abode of paradox. So when the tantrikas describe the fabric of reality, one of the things they point out is that it includes both dharma and adharma, both harmony and, you know, both alignment and misalignment, both goodness and the qualities of, let's call it, egoic misalignment that lead to cruelty and oppression and all the things that, you know, cause suffering, which come, in fact, from misalignment with cosmic law. And one of the questions we always ask is, you know, if everything is Shakti, how come everything is so screwed up? But it's the answer really is that this is the paradox of manifestation itself. That, you know, in order to really grok Shakti, to grok how reality, duality could coexist with non-duality, we have to understand, we have to actually not understand, we have to get, we have to feel paradox to recognize why the opposites are such a part of the mix in the goddess's embodiment in the world. One of the paradoxes that I would like to explore in the next few minutes is the nature of desire and the misunderstandings that we as spiritual people have about our desire for a worldly pleasure and our desire for spirit. You know, unless you're very ill or suffering a lot, and sometimes even then, we naturally love the physical world and our bodies and all the things that we're able to do because we have these bodies. And yes, we have fear and conflict about our lives and a lot of ambivalence when life is hard. But I think most of us have a deep feeling that life is good, even if it's just the goodness of water flowing down the body when you shower, or the taste of ice cream, or the beauty of the sunset. But, of course, we also have this deep draw towards what is beyond the physical world, and we notice that there are times when the two really do seem in conflict. So this pull towards the interior, towards the mystery of the invisible world, is just as deeply embedded in us as our love for the sensual. You know, and when we don't understand paradox, it can seem like there's a kind of an internal fight going on between the things that, you know, that draw us, which can be just as simple as, you know, wanting to watch TV instead of doing an evening chanting sadhana, which I don't care who you are, every single one of us is going to have to straddle that apparent contradiction sometimes. So the old style pre-tantric enlightenment traditions resolve this conflict, this paradox, by just teaching that in order to know the invisible world, you need to eliminate all desires for the material. You know, and they taught this world will not give freedom. Only the invisible world gives freedom. So a serious practitioner gives up attachments to people, to possessions, to experiences, in order to fully focus on the infinity of our nature, the wonder of our internal mystery. And there are even traditions in yoga. I know some of you have been steeped in these teachings. I was certainly taught in this tradition. Many of us have this idea embedded in us, however we've received it, that worldly pleasure is bad. You know, it's any desire besides longing for God is a mistake, is a false turn. And that anything that takes us away from full longing for spirit, you know, should not be engaged or indulged, lest it take us from the path. So as we walk the Shakti path, one of the inquiries that it's important to make is an inquiry into our ambivalence about the world and spirit, the push-pull of our different desires. And find a way not exactly to straddle them, but to walk in the center of the paradox. You know, learning to love the world in the tantric way is not materialism. And it's also not a tricky form of libertinism, you know, like some of the practices of what is sometimes called California Tantra or Pleasure Tantra. And yet, when we experience a glimpse of the vastness and beauty and mystery of the invisible world, it's very natural to feel this is the truth and everything else is just Maya. Because it really can feel that way. And yet for most of us, even when we're experiencing the beauty of the spiritual world, we simultaneously, or at least eventually, at least when we come out of meditation, we simultaneously feel our love for the gifts of this world. So, you know, to be, you know, really upfront about it, some part of us knows that, yes, looking for love only outside ourselves is going to leave us ultimately lonely and dissatisfied. But the opposite is also true. Spiritual love, spiritual connection, is not always enough for most people. You know, so it's true that there are those who are at the end of their karmic journey and really done with the material world. But a tantrika would say that your pull towards this world is an indication that we actually need to take seriously. Because, and this is why, because this is a non-dual teaching, and there actually are not two worlds. There's not a mundane world and a spiritual world. You know, it's the idea that there are two kinds of world, two kinds of love, two kinds of desire, is dualistic and hence false. And I don't care who you are or how much you believe in non-duality, until the moment of actual realization, you're going to constantly catch yourself separating your experience into spiritual and worldly as if there were parallel realities ever separate from each other. So in tantric practice, we recognize that we are going to experience the inner and outer worlds differently according to the state of consciousness that we're in, according to the guna that predominates, you know, according to the way our samskaras are manifesting. And we need to be very aware of that while at the same time recognizing that the two worlds are not separate. Shakti is always present in all of it. And actually so is Shiva, despite his being more and even more invisible and more fully concealed. So we could say that the physical world, the world of our outgoing sensual experience, is kind of the front of reality, meaning that, you know, when our eyes are open, when our senses are open to the world, we're moving front ways, you know. We're moving towards the exterior. We could say that the physical world is the exterior of reality, while the subtle world, the inner world, is the interior. It's the back of reality. And, you know, one of the reasons why I discovered and teach this practice about becoming aware of the region behind your heart and sensing the presence of an invisible being behind us is that practicing that way leads us into first the back body, and then somehow it makes it easier to recognize that spirit is right there present, even when your eyes are open and you're looking outside. So, you know, even though we experience our spiritual life as a journey, there actually is no distance between the inner and the outer, between physical experience and spiritual experience, any more that there's a distance between the skin and its molecules, between the heart and its cells. And for sure, it takes attention and willingness to see that the world and spirit are not different, that spirit interpenetrates the spiritual world and is accessible through any point. But this becomes particularly apparent when we begin to focus on the nature of desire, the nature of eros. So I'm going to say eros, meaning love that includes desire, is for most people the strongest force of shakti that we encounter in the physical world. You know, we associate eros with sexuality, as I said earlier, but it's actually much more than the sexual. In the Indian theory of the rasas, which we mentioned earlier, the erotic rasa is called Sringeri. It's associated with spring. It encompasses sexuality, romantic love, and the overall feeling of joyful creativity. In other words, joy. And, of course, in several tantric texts, the world is said to arise out of the erotic union between Shakti and her consort Shiva, and the culmination of our sadhana is the reunion, the lovemaking between these two forces. Eros is the indisputable expression of Shakti, not just in the physical world, but also in the invisible world. Since desire, which at this level is called Ichha, or divine will, is Shakti's first expression of creative intent, you know, even in her total immersion in divine bliss, at some point she is filled with the desire to create, to experience something. And this, of course, is the spur that for manifestation at her level and at our level. You know, desire is embedded in consciousness, and it existed in us long before we even knew what to want. You know, because we want because Shakti wants. And when we want, we become creatively inspired to draw the object of our desire towards us or to manifest something that will fulfill our desire. And if you remember how you feel when you really have been seized by desire, you know that there's something intrinsically alive about desire. You know, if you see very young kids who haven't yet learned to hide their desires, you know, you see the incredible power of wanting something that a two-year-old has. But of course, then we learn that we can't always have what we want, at least not the way we want it. So we learn to muffle our desires in order to handle the suffering of not having our needs responded to. But when we muffle our desires, the ecstatic urgency that the essence of desire also gets muffled. So we learn to focus our desires on certain things, on our careers, on our children's well-being, on, you know, being helpful. And when a personal desire feels like it's out of reach, you know, the cutest girl in school, the hot guy at work, the fabulous job, we tell ourselves, I can't ever get that job, or she doesn't feel the same way about me, so what's the point? Why even go there? So we get in the habit of suppressing desire. And for many of us, that means that it doesn't surface in our consciousness. So now it's obvious that desire tends to be, you know, egoic desire, individual desire, naturally tends to be focused outward, and it naturally tends to be based on a sense of lack, of wanting something that we don't have. So what do we do in order to experience desire that doesn't come out of lack, that doesn't come out of neediness? Because when you're experiencing a sense of lack, when you feel inwardly empty or missing something, then there's inevitably going to be grasping in your desire, and it's inevitably going to create suffering, which is, of course, the reason why all the spiritual traditions tell us that desire is the source of suffering. Because that kind of desire that comes out of lack, is the cause of suffering. Even when what we want is spiritual experience, you know, that kind of desire is known in the yogic texts as raga, and it's a powerful mayic force, as opposed to ichha, which is desire as the divine creative force. So ego-based desire is always experiences a need to fill up some kind of psychological emptiness. What psychologists call deficient emptiness. The nature of the self is also empty. In fact, one of the names for Shiva is Mahashunya. But the emptiness of the inner self has no feeling of lack because it's a profoundly full state of profound potential. What we often don't know how to do is to move past the grasping and emptiness to get to the shaktified heart of desire. So here's a question. What would it be like for you to let the feeling of wanting be present and allow it to show you what it really is and direct it into its root? What would it be like, first of all, to really, really, really let yourself want something and use that wanting to awaken your Shakti. So for a moment, let yourself allow a desire. I mean, a desire that is basically personal. It's only for you. And that may or may not be out of reach. Like the desire to be totally adored by somebody. Or the desire to be close to a particular person. Or the desire, you know, that might seem completely weird, the desire to be the leader of the free world, of the free world. I mean, allow yourself to feel even an outrageous desire and see if you can notice, as you allow a desire, that there is a bubbly, juicy, sparkly, fizzy feeling, kind of potency that we experience in desire, the natural aliveness of Eros. Which is the aliveness of the goddess. So this practice that we're about to do, which comes from the Vijnana Bhairava, is one that I experienced kind of spontaneously. Quite a while ago, I was in my 40s. I had a big crush on somebody. I was a swami at the time, so it was not an option. And he didn't have a crush on me. So, you know, even if I hadn't been a swami, it would not have been an option. So one day I was sitting in meditation. I felt this feeling arise of wanting this impossible person. And I decided to just let the feeling be there. It felt both sweet and painful, as unrequited desire can. But instead of witnessing or pushing it away, I decided to let myself feel it, to really get into it. So I began to cultivate the desire, and I actually found myself talking to this person. I love you, I want to be with you, I want you to love me. And as it did, the swell of intense romantic love, thrilling love, began to arise in me. And as I focused on this feeling, and as I focused on the feeling, and you know this is the process, I actually let go of the person for a moment. And as I did, I began to feel my attention being pulled backward as if I were being pulled into myself. I could feel the love, the desire, and a feeling that it was being reciprocated from within me. In other words, that I was meeting the beloved, but instead of being another person, the beloved was an inner realm of love and presence. It was extraordinary. It was actually one of the most ecstatic meditations I've ever had. And I also want to say that it's perfectly possible to have this feeling with another person actually there, with an external beloved. But if you want to cultivate this with another person, it's really important that you first establish the connection to your own internal source, which for most of us means with the energy in your heart. And often, you know, the process of using desire and longing as a portal into pure Shakti involves some pain. You know, the longing and desire and even the feeling of emptiness. Not because you're going to stay stuck in the pain, but to acknowledge that moving into full inner Eros and presence asks vulnerability of us. It asks us to be willing to be, to feel feelings that we might normally want to protect ourselves from. This is an emotionally based desire, and you can, you know, when we do this practice, you can do it with a emotional desire or a, you know, a, I don't know, even a career desire. But you might want to practice with a sexual desire, some of you. Whether you're working with the felt sense of desire through the heart or with the sexual center in the area around the genitals, the purpose of this practice is to start to feel where the desire comes from. In other words, to feel that force as an internal arising, which may be triggered by an other, which actually is the force of the goddess's love inside you. And you'll be able to use that force to take you to your own center, which ideally will mean that when you share love and desire with another person, it'll be inundated with that feeling that comes from having found your center. So find a desire that has juice for you, enough juice that it feels a little bit exciting to work with it. And if you're not finding a desire that's completely obvious to you, my suggestion is that you use a sexual fantasy, that you let yourself have a sexual fantasy and create the felt sense of sexual desire. Most of us know how to do this. So it's kind of a great shortcut into this practice. But the desire can be anything. Kindle the desire. And see if you can focus on what it feels like to really experience the pulsation of wanting. And focus fully on it. Let it get stronger. You know, you might use words like, I want this and I'm going to have it. I deserve this. I get to have this. I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to feel it. I want this. And when you've found the height of your desire for now, use your attention like an arrow, focusing on the place in your body, if any, where you're experiencing it. Feel that the desire is being sucked inward, as if into the space behind your body. Let go of the thoughts as they arise. You may still be feeling the desire connected to the object, that's fine. But stay in touch with the visceral, sensory, felt sense of desire. Even as you notice the feelings and thoughts that come up around it. Soften your body around the area you're connected to. Soften your belly and shoulders and face. Meditate on the felt sense of desire as strongly as you can at this moment. The goddess in her form as desire is sometimes shown as a red hibiscus or as a rose. Can you create a flower out of the energy of desire in your own body? Can you then feel it as though you were offering it to the goddess? Imagine that you offer your desire in the form of a flower to the Shakti herself. And then feel that she offers it back to you. That she's showing you that the interior of your desiring is her pleasure, her essential divine rasa. Sit with this sense of having received desire as the goddess's gift. What feelings can you be receptive to? What can you allow yourself to recognize about your own eros, your own desiring nature? Don't worry if it doesn't feel as powerful as it might, or if it feels super powerful. All forms of desire can show us the truth about itself. Sit with this, just allowing the warmth of desire to radiate through your body from the center outward and upward. There's a further place to go with this practice where you allow this desire to be transmuted into spiritual longing, and that may be happening for some of you. And it will happen eventually. As you cultivate the practice of feeling the pure force of desire, the pure energy of desire, using an object as kindling inspiration, but really keeping your focus on the felt sense of wanting. In time, it will show you that what you really want is constantly rising upward from within yourself, and that desire can be ridden back to that source with enough practice, enough skill, and enough curiosity. You can discover how desire is the first movement of the goddess's creative power. And that when we recognize it as such and offer it back to her, she'll show us this. So take a deep breath in. And a slow, soft exhale. Notice what's happening in your body right now. And we're going to now, sit near the goddess through a visual practice and allow ourselves to be gifted with her Shakti of fulfillment of divine abundance. Inhaling and exhaling. Let go of the thoughts you have about the practice we just did, and perhaps allow yourself to feel the energy of it. And with your eyes closed, find letting the breath move you into an upright and comfortable posture. Find yourself in a garden. It's twilight. You're seated comfortably on a low-backed chair. There's a sliver of moon in the sky. Above you is a huge old oak tree. And as you sit beneath it, leaning your back against the trunk of the tree, you realize that the tree is sheltering you, just as the ancient wisdom shelters you. You're supported by the trunk of this great tree, and your breath is flowing softly and evenly. The goddess herself is seated in front of you. She's very informal. She's golden. She's wrapped in red silk robes. She has pearls around her neck. Or maybe she looks different. Maybe she's in another form. Or maybe you experience her simply as a feeling or a sense of radiance. Let yourself to feel the presence of the Shakti of abundance and fulfillment. Let yourself realize that you're sitting with her, you're sitting near her. Bring your hands into Anjali Mudra. And make a gesture of bowing to her. And then looking up, feel that she is gazing at you with an infinite desire to fill you with her radiance. From her heart flows a golden mist. It flows into your heart and begins to enter you through every pore of your body. So as you inhale the light of the goddess's abundance, of her absolute fullness, feel her filling you through the heart, slowly and gently radiating this sense of grace through your body. And then as you exhale, allow the abundant feeling to flow back towards her in the eternal gesture of giving and receiving. As the goddess offers you her abundance, she's offering you herself. How much can you open yourself to receive her? How much can you take in the presence that's flowing through your breath, flowing from her heart to yours, flowing back from your heart to hers. Right now, bring your hands and fists to the center of your chest. Feel that you pull the front of your body apart so that your heart is an open space, a doorway to be filled by the goddess's love. And just breathe her in and breathe her out. Rest in her. Recognize that you are receiving the goddess's blessing of abundance, and that this blessing will continue to unfold for a really long time. This is a relationship, whether you experience her in a form or simply as a feeling, as a presence. This is a relationship, and as you sit near her, she will gradually, over time, fill you with not only her radiance and her presence, but fill you with the deep conviction that you are not small and stuck and limited. You are a form of her. Just as she lives in the sun and the moon, she fully lives in you. And lives in all this. In every one of us. Including the gnarly parts. So as we bring our so much love to all of you. Jai Devi. Jai Devi. Jai Devi. And as we end, the music will come on. And we can go into the night listening to Krishna Das chanting the hymn to the Devi.
Om Namah Chandikaya. Chandikaya. Om Namah Chandikaya. Jayanti Mangala Kali Badrakali Kapalini Durga Kshama Shivadatri Swaha Swadhanamostute Jayatvam Devi Chamande Jaya Bhuta Diharini Jaya Sarvagate Devi Kalaratri Namostute Madhukaitava Hidravi Dhatri Varade Namaha Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Mahishasura Nirnashi Bhaktanam Sukade Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dvisho Jehi Shambhasya Eva Shambhasya Dhumrakshasya Chamadini Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Jehi Natebhyaha Sarvadha Bhaktya Chandike Duritapahe Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Jehi Dehi Sobhagyam Arogyam Dehi Me Paramasukam Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Dehi Devi Kalyanam Dehi Paramam Shriyam Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Jehi Himachala Dana Samstute Parameshwari Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Jehi Indrani Pati Sabharam Pujite Parameshwari Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Jehi Devi Prachanda Daradanda Daitya Darpa Vinashini Rupam Dehi Jayam Dehi Yasho Dehi Visho Jehi Patni Manorama Dehi Manovritanu Sarini Paranim Durga Samsara Sagarasya Kaloba Rupande Jayanme Yashode Vidushode Rupande Jayanme Yashode
Show me your show.
surely.